brethren and sisters and dear young people. In our class last time, we considered the first eight verses of Hebrews chapter 6, even though we took our title from verse 9, which is where, God willing, we will start in a few moments' time. You may recall that the theme of the last class, as taken from verse 9, was, "Beloved, we are persuaded better things of you." This may remind us of the fact that in our last class, picking up the words of the Apostle Paul, we found that the first eight verses of this chapter were really words of denunciation. And because it's all part of Scripture, which is there and is profitable for doctrine and for reproof and for correction and for instruction in righteousness, we endeavoured to see how it might apply in a 20th century ecclesia. And on that occasion we put up this overhead transparency, which some of you were able to read and some weren't able to read. And I just want to quickly go through that again as a lead into what we want to talk about tonight. And I would mention that we ran off about 30 or 40 paper copies of that. There were some people asked for it. And those paper copies will be available from whoever's currently got them at the moment. The last person to have them was my wife as I handed them to her going through the door. Have you got them there, David? No, you haven't. Have you got them? Right. They're currently with Phil, and I think she's going to pass them on to David or something. Anyway, for those who weren't able to see that and would like a copy of it, it is available. I have actually written on the top of the copy that you'll get, if you get one, words which say, this chart should be read in conjunction with Paul's exhortation in Hebrews 5, verse 11 to 6, verse 20, and relevant comments made at the Tea Tree Gully Bible class 12th of February 92. I'm not one that normally worries too much where notes and tapes and that go, but I think, though, that these comments on here were very much related to our Bible class, and if someone took them out of their context, I suppose they could use them to prove all sorts of things if they really wanted to. So you will find that note on the top, and it's just in case it does get somewhere where somebody reads something into it they shouldn't. Now, of course, what Paul was telling us was that there was a real danger, if a person was just going to stick with first principles. And these people continually repeating first principles really leave themselves open to being a problem to themselves and to their ecclesia. And I think probably for most of us, the first time we come to realise that that's what Hebrews 6 is saying, are brought up with a bit of a jolt, and in all fairness to ourselves and our ecclesia, we say, well, look, how could I be fitting into this particular category? And as we said, it was fairly much a negative class in many respects in looking at the problems. Tonight, of course, we pick it up where he says, well, I'm persuaded better things of you, and tonight will be very much a positive approach to how we can remedy the problem. But just to review the problem again as we saw it, we've got the condition, the symptoms and the result on this side related to those who live on what Paul calls the milk diet, and we've got the condition, the symptoms and the result of those that he would say are on the meat diet. The meat diet meaning that they have gone on to maturity. I think we ought to say again that by going on to maturity, I think it's right to say that deep Bible students are not particularly those who take one subject and go into it a tremendous depth. There can be even a danger with that, in as much as they may almost get blinkers on and get a sort of a tunnel vision. The deep student, the person who is living on the meat of the word, is the person who's continually taking that word in. And yes, they are going into it in depth, but they're also doing it on a fairly broad front, so that they're able to get a balanced approach to the understanding of the scriptures. So what that means is that every one of us then can become deep students. Every one of us is capable of being a deep student to the limit that we are able to be a deep student. And we must never compare ourselves with others and say, well, that person's cleverer than me, or got more time than me, or been in the truth longer than me, because God is going to judge us according to our own respective capacities, to pick up a word from the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. So I want to say that by way of encouragement, because some people might feel that where we keep telling you've got to be a deep student, you've got to be a deep student, they have in mind some sort of a student who is just the absolute pinnacle of intellectual ability. in which case it would rule probably all of us out. So the meek diet then is the person who applies themselves continually to the word and builds up that mature approach to the truth, because that word is going in the eyes and in the ears continually. So the milk diet then, as defined by Paul, is one who is unskillful in the word of righteousness, chapter 5 verse 13, as distinct from one who is skillful in the word of righteousness, the meek diet. The milk diet will be, the condition will be a lack of spiritual discernment, chapter 5 verse 14. On the other hand, the person who is on the meek diet, they have their senses exercised in spiritual discernment. The person on the milk diet, therefore, is immature, and incidentally, although they might be a very technical student of the Bible, they might spend a lot of time doing a sort of a technical type of study, like a Mr. Strong or a Mr. Young or a Mr. Vine or someone like that might do in making up a concordance or a lexicon, but they're still immature because they're not developing those priestly qualities, which are the true signs of maturity. So they are immature, the others progress to maturity. And we could summarise it in these words, both taken from Hebrews, that the milk diet then causes a person to mistake the shadow for the substance. And they can be very busy in the truth, doing a lot of work, but it's all following the shadow. And we've spoken about that many times in classes. We don't really need to go over that. So all of us then have to go home and say, look, what am I doing? I'm busy, but is it just the shadow or is it the substance? And of course, we can't get rid of the shadow entirely, can we? We've got to have our organisation. We've got to have our standards. We've got to have our secretaries and our recorders and our finance brother and our teachers and our speakers, and all of those things are duties to be performed, which in a sense are shadowy things. But all of us have to ensure that we're able to see the substance, which is Christ. So consequently, the condition then that would apply to one on the meat diet would be that they fix their eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. So they were then the two sets of conditions. Now, because most of us, in fact I'd say all of us, have a great deal of difficulty in examining ourselves, we have to really look at the symptoms of our condition. And Paul also tells us what these symptoms might be. In the case of the person who's on the milk diet, they reiterate first principles, but they have no depth of knowledge. So a person who is all the time, just say, involved in gospel work and maybe tutoring interested friends, I mean, that's good and it's very helpful and it keeps their mind on the word. And I would be very loath to say that it was something bad or even that it was limited. But there could be a danger if they're not feeding themselves on something deeper, that in fact, they will put themselves in this very dangerous position, which we'll come to in just a moment. So we've got to be careful we're just not reiterating first principles and have no depth of knowledge, as in chapter 6, verse 1. The counterpart to that, of course, is those spoken of in chapter 4, verse 12, where the word which is in them is living, that is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. And those of us who are continually reading the scriptures to absorb its message will be using the word in that way. And whilst we are using Greek and Hebrew words in our studies, what we are saying is you don't have to know a lot of Hebrew and Greek to be able to do that. We just have to be honest with ourselves. So the symptoms would be a reiteration of first principles as distinct from one who is able to use that word on themselves and in a kindly way on others. How might it be seen personally? Well, it could be a person who in their personal life would be dependent upon rules, not principles. So when they come to making a decision, they just say, well, what should I do? And they may go and ask someone. And someone will say, well, do this. And the next time they come up and say, well, what shall I do? And you say, well, wait a minute, how often do you have to go to somebody else for the answer? Can't you work it out yourself? And of course, with a child, rightly so, they are under rules. And when Israel was a child, they were under the law of Moses. So rules have their place. There is no doubt about that. And we would set certain things in our lives as things we don't do or don't want to do. Perhaps we end up doing them as against things that we do do. But there's got to be more to it than that. That would be a state of immaturity if in our personal lives we were dependent upon rules rather than on principles. The counterpart to that would be a life based upon spiritual discernment, not law. And it may therefore mean that we might do different things in different places because of different circumstances. The person who's immature in the word would say, inconsistency. And it's not inconsistency at all. Not necessarily so. It could be, but not necessarily so. And so, you see, Paul would say that to the Greek he was a Greek, to the Romans he was a Roman, to the Jews he was a Jew. There were plenty of people that were telling Paul that he was inconsistent. But you see, Paul understood principles. And the person who can spiritually discern the things of the truth will make the decision which they consider to be appropriate for the particular circumstance. And there could well be a brother or sister or a group of brethren or sisters in the ecclesia who will condemn them for acting differently, and those people would be perhaps in their own mind thinking they are being strong, when in fact two things could apply. One, they could be a person who's simply living on a milk diet, or as we remember from our study of Romans 14, they could be people who have a weak conscience. And there's nothing wrong with having a weak conscience, providing you don't stand in... Can we remember our word from Romans 14? What does the person with the weak conscience do? They stand in judgment, don't they? They condemn the person who says, I can. And so in ecclesial life, we've got to try and analyse our position, don't we? And it could well be that in some circumstances I am immature and in other circumstances I am mature. And it could well be that you, whoever you might be, are the opposite. And that's where we have to help each other. So we've got to be very careful, don't we, when we stand off and condemn somebody, before examining the circumstances carefully, and then give them the benefit of the doubt, in many cases, that they've done it out of a good conscience. So we could then have, in our ecclesial life, people who, in their own personal lives, they make rules for themselves, and they expect everybody else to abide by those same rules. Now, on the basis of both Romans 14, which says if it's a non-fundamental matter, you can't do that, and it's wrong to do that, any more than it's wrong for the brother with the strong conscience to what, the weak conscience? To despise. Remember, the weak tends to condemn, the strong tends to despise. And so there is a certain connection between our study of Romans 14 and this one. So personally then, if we're a person that's dependent upon rules and not principles, let's make sure that our life is based on spiritual discernment, which may mean that we make different judgments in different places because of different circumstances for the well-being of the person on the other end, not to create a stumbling block or to provide a proper environment. How could it apply ecclesially? As one would look around the ecclesial world or look at the Tea Tree Gully Ecclesia. Could we say that here is an ecclesia that is bound by constitution, not common sense? I used the word constitution there for two reasons, and I won't go through it all again this week. One, because it's a little bit of alliteration. You've got a C and a C, and it's sometimes handy to remember that. And the other thing is, well, in personal lives we make our own rules. In ecclesial life we have our constitutional rules. And of course, as we pointed out, when you found an ecclesia, you have a constitution. A constitution is there as a foundation, but you don't live on that. You've got to go on from that. And as I said last time, does that mean at times you may break the constitution? And the answer is yes. You've got to be very careful how you do it. You don't want to put an ecclesia in an uproar, not by any means. But if there's going to be such a thing as what we would call over here spiritual common sense based upon spiritual discernment, then of course we must go on to maturity, and we must not be bound by some sort of rule which could be detrimental to the spiritual development of the ecclesia. So the counterpart to that was, we seek no personal glory but the good of the body. And he picks that up in chapter 5, verses 4 and 5. Such people who live on the milk diet have no fruit in themselves or their family, but on the other hand, those who live on the meat show forth the fruits of the Spirit. That's chapter 6, verse 8 and chapter 6, verse 7. There is a fear of judgment on the part of those who live on the milk diet. On the other hand, those who are mature come confidently, openly, freely, even boldly, as the word is in the King James Version, before the throne of grace, as we're told in chapter 4, verse 16. How does it apply to our trials in life? The milk diet person succumbs to trial rather than submits to it. chapter 5 verses 7 to 9 picks this up, and we would compare James chapter 1. The end result is they blame others for failure, even God himself. And every ecclesia, including Tea Tree Gully, had people going around saying, it's not my fault that I've made this mistake, it's somebody else's fault. Somebody has set too high a standard, I can't live up to it, so it's their fault. And we do have people going around blaming others for their failures. They've got to be very, very careful in looking at themselves and saying, well, what am I doing? Why am I succumbing to the trial? It's my fault. And in fact, as James points out, these people can end up even blaming God himself for it. That's, you know, why did it have to happen to me? So what do we do? Well, in time of trial, we submit to trial. And the very submission to trial, even if it's a trial which has been brought upon us in which people unfairly treat us. Perhaps it was the fault of some brother or sister who said something they shouldn't have said or didn't do something they should have done. All those things are quite possible, but that's not going to make me any better by complaining about it. I submit to trial, and in so doing I develop maturity and patience. Such people then, to pick up the words of Hebrews 5 verse 3, acknowledge their own weaknesses in common with others and had compassion on the ignorant whilst not condoning sin. The result? A milk diet, we will be rejected as unfit to be king priests in the kingdom. Not that we haven't done enough work, not that we haven't done enough good deeds, it's just we never developed the basic attributes of a king priest. We're too busy justifying ourselves, blaming others, making rules, all of those sort of things which are signs, or should I say, can be signs, because we've got to be careful in making blanket statements. And I hope no one will go away and say that John Knoll said we shouldn't have a constitution. I didn't say that at all. But they can be signs of spiritual immaturity. On the other hand, the result from those who are developing the meat of the word, they are accepted as fit for king priests in the kingdom. And I would like that to be accepted, brethren and sisters, in the spirit in which it is presented. And that is that it is part of that section where Paul is denouncing that ecclesia, and we have to read it in just such words. Now, having said that, he then turns around and says, but, beloved, we are persuaded better things of you. And it's not without significance that that word better is there, which we know is perhaps the key word in the book of Hebrews. And what he's saying, therefore, is, well, there is something better which I know you are capable of. And so in a characteristic fashion, Paul now encourages his readers to a positive attitude towards the problem. So having reminded ourselves then of what the problem was, not just the symptoms of the problem, but what the problem is, he encourages them towards a positive attitude. Certainly his words of rebuke would have depressed and alarmed them, perhaps even angered some. But he doesn't leave them in such a negative state. And you probably guess I'm reading from the notes here on page 58. He says, we would do well to closely ponder his example in our own dealings with brethren and sisters. So he says then, I'm convinced that you can do better because you started off well and there were some virtues that you have, but if you're going to understand what this Melchizedek high priest is all about, bear in mind that's what this section is all about, and we're going to, God willing, in next class, start chapter 7. If you want to understand what this Melchizedek priesthood is all about, then you've got to stop being dull of hearing. You've got to be mature in your understanding. And so he says in that verse 9, but beloved, we are persuaded better things of you and things that accompany salvation, though we thus speak. And though we thus speak, the NIV says, even though we speak like this, dear friends, we are confident of better things in your case. And brethren and sisters, we have to try and be like that when somebody criticises us. When a criticism appears to be made from the platform, and I don't think my words are meant to be criticism, words are meant to say, well, here are the possible dangers that any one of us could fall into. When the criticism from the platform, it's fairly easy to absorb. When it's done on a one-to-one basis, then of course it's not so easy, is it? And we have to consider that in wounding a friend, that if we're going to do such, then whilst it is better than the kisses of an enemy, it has to be done with the desire to improve and to redeem and to restore. And therefore, Paul is going to go on and do that in general terms. I'm actually going to spend a bit of time tonight doing it more specifically, even moving outside of Hebrews for a reasonably substantial part of the night in a few moments' time. So even though Paul has spoken severely and very directly concerning their lack of development and understanding, he is mindful of the need to encourage and redirect them in a positive way. So our theme for tonight then, which is taken from verse 12, is that we should be followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. Now some of you may have already studied Hebrews chapter 6 and you know what he's going to build out of those two words. Some of you don't. So let me just tell you where he's going and then you'll see where we're going to head as well. These two words, faith and patience, become key words in the example that he's going to take from the life of Abraham. And all of us down to virtually the youngest know that Abraham was justified by faith of when he heeded the call to come out of Ur of the Chaldees and when he believed God. And in Genesis chapter 15, God made that covenant with him. And then he was later on justified by his works in Genesis chapter 22, when he was prepared to offer up Isaac. That's the term that James uses, faith and works. But the word works goes a little bit further than that, because it wasn't just that one incident of offering up Isaac. It was a whole life from the time when he showed his faith in believing that God could make his seed like the sand of the seashore, right through to that time and even beyond. So it was a life of continual endurance. And the word patience really is the word endurance. So when it talks here about faith and patience, or faith and endurance, he's going to cite the case of Abraham. Now we want to talk about that too. If we're going to go on to maturity, then there's two things that are needed. It's faith and it's endurance. Now faith doesn't just stop, does it, when we're baptised? And so what I would like to talk about this evening, brethren and sisters, and I hope that the older ones, or the ones who've been in the truth a bit long, don't think that this is a bit too simple for a Bible class. I want to talk about Bible study for 10 or 15 minutes. Because if we're starting to feel that, well, what hope have I got? I'm obviously immature. And to become mature, I'm being told all the time I've got to study, 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 study. I don't know where to start. And I think many of us get a surprise at times in talking to somebody who's been in the truth for quite some time to hear them say, look, I don't know how to study. So I'm going to assume that there are some of us here tonight that are in that category, and I'd like to speak a little bit about how we can go about doing study. Now let's bear in mind too that we've got different situations. One of the things that I think is very important is our family Bible study. And the sort of study that we do with our children. I can recall certainly around about 10 years ago in this ecclesia that there were many families were setting aside a particular night, and whilst it wasn't a formal thing by any means, I know that Tuesday nights with many people were set aside for the family Bible study night. And either consciously or directly or indirectly, we tried to avoid Tuesday nights for formal meetings. And we would go through little projects, whether it was preparation for Junior Elpis Israel or whether it was going through doing our marking up of the traditional words like world and love and devil and the name and titles of deity. And those things will bind a family together. And it's the simplest sort of studies you can do and very easily done. I mean, there's that sort of thing. There's obviously the sort of studies coming up the scale a little bit that our teenagers do. And probably the teenagers would do more study than perhaps people older or younger. Now, before they start to feel a bit smug about that, let's bring them back to reality. They probably do it because of peer group pressure in many respects. Because you've got to have it done for Claret, and you've got to have it done for Tattachilly, you've got to have it done for end of year studies, you've got to have it done for the youth conference. And when there's a bit of pressure there, well then, okay, we go ahead and do it, and are we doing it sort of with the right motivation? Then when we get older and we get past all that,
do we still do our study? Well, what I'm going to suggest is that there are different ways in which we can go about doing Bible study. And what I've got here is a transparency, which I don't think you've seen exactly this one before. Some of you may have seen a similar version to it some time back. I've called it Studying the Bible, an example of an Old Testament book. Why an Old Testament book? Well, the transparency was done for an Old Testament book. That's the first and honest reason. And I haven't got one for a New Testament book. But the second thing is, I think when you've finished it, you'll see, I think there's more to studying an Old Testament book. Maybe a New Testament book in some respects is easier to get into. I mean, if Paul's writing to the Colossians, well, you might know a little bit about Colossae, you might know a little bit about Paul, get into it. But when you're studying a book, and this one was originally done for Habakkuk, then you say, Habakkuk, you know, when did he live, where did he live, who was he writing to, what was he writing about, what's all this about poetry, what's all this about Psalms, and it does get a little bit more involved, but it can also be very beneficial. So all of us can set about with a procedure, something like this. Now, we wouldn't necessarily do all of the things that are on the sheet here, but all of us can do at least some of them, and we should be doing these things in order that we might keep reinforcing that faith and in so doing develop a mature understanding. We're saying then that step number one would be to examine the background to the book. Now, we've got to be careful here because some would have thought in times past that it's absolutely imperative that you've got to establish the background, and that you can't study a book unless you have the background. And even when the background isn't stated, you've got to create a background. I was almost going to say fabricate one. But there are some books of the Bible in which you just don't know the background. So you've got to treat them all differently. And I think there's probably three possible alternatives. If the background is clearly stated, such as a book like Isaiah, which says the word of Yahweh that came to Isaiah, the son of Amoz, in the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz and Hezekiah, it's telling us that we should study the reigns of those kings to be able to understand most of what Isaiah is talking about. If you want to know the Emmanuel prophecy from chapters 7 to 12, then you really need to know the reign of Ahaz, and the counterpart to that in chapters 36 to 39, the life of Hezekiah. So you really need to know about the reigns of those kings to study books like Isaiah. On the other hand, it might not be clearly stated, but it might be implied. And Habakkuk is a case like that. Reference is made to the Chaldeans. So you say, well, it's somewhere around about the time when Babylon was either on the move or about to be on the move. So we can identify it approximately, and therefore we can get some idea of the setting, but we can't pin it down to an exact date like we would, say, with the prophecy of Isaiah. And subsequent points further down will show us how we will handle these differently. The third one, and this was the one that I get a real crotchet about, are books like, say, Joel, in which it is impossible to define when Joel was written. And reputable authorities will vary by 150 years. And yet we've had in circulation in the Brotherhood at times notes on the book of Joel which purport to tell us the very day of the very month of the very year in which it was written. Now, even if it was right, it's a very wrong way of going about Bible study, because if you were right that time and you apply it every other time, you've got to be wrong sooner or later, and my suggestion would be that you're going to be wrong 99 times out of 100, and you could therefore end up building a wrong structure because you've got a wrong foundation. So if it's not stated, then the background is not relevant, which means that the message can apply wherever and whenever like conditions prevail. In which case, to go about studying it, you would need to see points 2, 4, etc., which you can't see at the moment, but you will in a moment. So we look at the background. Yes, we could also apply that to a New Testament book as well, up to a point. I wouldn't want to get into an argument on this, and I mean argument with a small a. I've never worried too much about when Paul wrote his letters.
some people make a big issue of it. Perhaps I'm wrong, I don't know, I've never bothered to do it. I just sort of read Ephesians as Ephesians. Whether it was written to Ephesus or Laodicea or a circular letter, it doesn't seem to matter much. If the problems here are the same as the problems there, then the remedy is the same. Some people put a lot of time into finding the dates when those letters were written, and once again, I'm not sure that you can always be certain about those dates, and if you are, what you would do with it. But as I said, I wouldn't want to get into a disagreement on that. Just raise the question, how relevant is it? Also, brethren and sisters, I don't want to be accused at the end of the night of making Bible study sound so simple. You don't need to know the background, you don't need to know this, you don't need to know that, that by the end of the night people say, well, Bible study just means you virtually do nothing. I'm not trying to say that. I'm trying to say, let's not put our energies in a direction which is a wrong direction. Like spending all our time trying to work out whether it was a pre-Adamic creation, and if we got an answer to it, what good would it do us anyway? Those sorts of things which we might call invalid questions. And a background could be invalid. And usually it's fairly quick to see with the Old Testament books what the background is, or isn't, as the case might be. The writer. What do we know about the writer? Well, two things we may or may not know. One is personal details. Jeremiah and Ezekiel, for example, we know a lot about them. We get a lot of the personal details of how they felt about it. Jeremiah said, I determined never to speak any more in the name of God, but his word was in my heart as a burning fire. I was weary with forbearing. I could not stay. Got thrown into a pit. We know all of those things. Ezekiel, we know the drama he went through with his wife dying, and it all had to be a sign. A lot of personal details about them. There are other men that we know nothing about their lives. Take, for example, one in the next line, Malachi. We don't even know whether Malachi was really his name. Some suggest it was a sort of a title, because Malachi means my messenger, and there were five messengers in the book of Malachi, including Malachi himself. So was it really a title, a bit perhaps like Melchizedek is? So if we know the personal details, then that's important. If we don't, then it's not important. But the meaning of the name could well be important, and we won't give a dissertation on all the names that we happen to be able to remember. So find out what we can about the writer. Now, up till now, you see, there's nothing there that anybody in this room, who's baptised at least, couldn't do. We can do that by just reading the book, can't we? How do we find the meaning of the names of the writer? Well, a concordance and a Bible dictionary is probably all you'd need. Problem comes when they disagree, and that sometimes happens. Well, it sometimes happens, and we just have to do the best we can then with the limited information we've got. But by and large, it's usually fairly easy to find. The theme. Well, that's important, very important, isn't it, to find out the theme of the book that we're studying. And that can be done usually by a careful reading. Now, once again, everybody can do a careful reading. Perhaps that's one of our biggest dangers. Perhaps we're not careful enough. Perhaps we just go to Bible class and listen. Perhaps we just do our reading and rush through it. But a very careful reading. You know, Brother Thomas was incredible, wasn't he? How he would pick up a word and he'd build a story out of this word, and you think, hey, how does he get that? And you go back and look at the context and you say, that's right. He recognised that every word was important. What examples have we got here? Well, we've got the example of recurring words and phrases. And you've got Ezekiel. They shall know that I am Yahweh. Ye shall know that I am Yahweh. About 100 times. And about the same number of times he's called Son of Man. It's got to be significant. What's some other books of the Bible that have got recurring phrases that might give us a clue to the thing? I'm sure you've got some ideas. Any book of the Bible you can think of that's got recurring phrases?
Isn't Jeremiah?
Yeah, Isaiah, isn't it? It doesn't occur a tremendous number of times, but I consider it one of the key phrases in Isaiah, yes, about 9 or 10, 11, 12, but it's enough to make it significant. Yes, Isaiah, the Holy One of Israel, I would think would be one of the key phrases in Isaiah. The word suffering in Peter. I don't know the answer to that, but you could be right. I mean, I don't know all the answers to everything, so I'll accept what you say and without comment if necessary.
Revelation,
yes, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the ecclesias. That's right. And whilst we're in Revelation, what's the other one that's related to that? Some of the young people? What's the one that's related to that? Do you want me to name anybody? Right, one of the girls in the front row. What's the other one that's related to he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the ecclesias? Sarah, to him. Oh, you haven't been in Sunday school for a couple of weeks. That's right, you've been teaching. Okay. Cool. Elizabeth. To him that... That's right, to him that overcometh. And the word overcometh is an important word in the book of Revelation. The Nicolaitans were those who were the overcomers, the vanquishers of the people. Nikos, to overcome, laos, the people. So in the book of Revelation, either the flesh overcomes the spirit or the spirit overcomes the flesh. Right, key word. Day of the Yahweh and Zephaniah, yes, and probably there'd be a few other books like that. I think Zechariah's got something like that. Barry, what's the one in Zechariah? In that day, is it? In that day in Zechariah. Okay, well look, we want to get back to Hebrews, don't we? But what we're saying is, here are little things that we can pick up just by our reading. Or it might be implied in the writer's name, such as the book of Daniel, Daniel, the judgments of Ael. Ezekiel also is significant, and there are plenty of examples of where the theme can be found either in recurring words and phrases or even implied in the writer's name. I would think that this latter one wouldn't be very appropriate in the New Testament. I couldn't see many books of the New Testament. Apocalypse, yes. I think that would be about it, wouldn't it? You know, Isaiah is the salvation of Yah. Jeremiah is whom Yahweh appoints and exalts. Ezekiel, it means strengthened by ale. And all of those are appropriate, and we keep going through. So that's why I picked, one of the reasons we picked an Old Testament book. Please butt in if you've got something to add to it. Now, this is one that some of you might like to, I won't say leave out, but you wouldn't want to go into it as deep as somebody else. But don't ignore it. It mustn't be ignored, but at the same time, this is where some students may be deeper than others, because that's the way they go. And that is what we'll call literary style. Probably the title itself's a bit frightening, but what it's saying is that we should distinguish between something that's written in ordinary language, which we call prose, as distinct from poetry, as distinct from symbol, as distinct from metaphor. Prose, well, of course, books like Kings and Chronicles and that would be generally prose. Poetry, of course, the Psalms are poetry, and something like about 75%, about three quarters of the books of the prophets are written in poetry, which is something we may not be aware of. And that's important too, because if you read something that's poetry as though it were prose, you could get the wrong idea. Obviously, you'll get into some serious difficulty if you mistake prose for symbol, or symbol for prose, whichever way you like to put it. And imagine, for example, that there is such a thing as a dreadful and terrible fourth beast like Daniel saw in chapter 7. You say, well, nobody would do that. Perhaps not, but there are some people who make the beast of Revelation with a tail that draws the third part of the stars of heaven a real thing, don't they? Not Christadelphians, hopefully, but people get mixed up between symbol and literal. And metaphor, or figure, well, things like the parables, particularly in the book of Ezekiel, where he had it to enact certain things like lying on his side for 390 days and turning over for 40 days on the other side, and cutting off his hair and splitting it up into three parts, and all of those sorts of things were enacted parables. So, yes, the literary style. There's not much out on that. Very, very little on that. I think probably the only writer, and it's not a Christadelphian writer, who did much on that is Moulton. And there's a Bible called the Reader's Bible. I don't think it's available new nowadays. Has anybody seen a Moulton Reader's Bible new? Huh? No? I managed to acquire one when I was in the Christadelphian office in Birmingham once, and there was a pile of books there that someone had donated to the office, and there was one of these on the top, and I spoke nicely to Brother Alfred Nicholson, got one that way. but he also wrote a book called A Literary Study of the Bible, which I've read the first four or five pages, and that's all I need. Some other people might read further, and it's been very helpful because it points out some of the dreadful mistakes that people have made in not recognising that something was poetry and they read it as prose, and they've therefore tried to identify different people with... We'll put it this way. In poetry, your second line is usually a parallel of the first line in some form or other. So it's simply saying the same thing. You don't have to look for something additional and different and therefore have identify more people. Let's leave it at that without making it any worse. The structure, well, that's a fairly important thing, what we would call the telescopic view, in which we go through and do subheadings, and Christadelphia abounds with those sorts of notes. I doubt whether there's a book of the Bible in which we wouldn't have some set of notes out which will give us the structure and the outline of that book. And as probably most of you are aware, we're endeavouring to do that in a simple sort of way through the Logos, with each month doing a simple article on the daily readings, which really, by and large, focuses on the general structure of the book and maybe tries to highlight any other features which can be fitted into three pages or whatever it is that are allocated to that particular section. Citations or quotations. Now, here's a good family project, especially during the course of the daily readings from the New Testament. Why don't we make it a project every day we do the daily readings from the New Testament to say, right, we're going to watch for Old Testament quotations and somehow or other identify them. And that can be done. I simply underline in red an Old Testament quotation. And looking at Hebrews 5, 6 and 7, which is open at the moment, I can see there 1, 2, 3, 3. I think that's about it. And okay, it's good to be able to do that, because once the writer quotes the old, then of course he's opening up a new field of thought. And that's why we could say earlier in the night, when we talk about faith and patience, we know he's going to talk about Abraham, because when I get to verse 14, it's all underlined in red and the cross reference is Genesis 22, so it's got to be Abraham he's got in mind. And that's important. So citations, Old Testament in the new, or new in the old. And then you can do step number 7, which is what we traditionally call Bible marking, in which we go through and do verse by verse marking. Well, we may never get to that. I've got books in the Bible that I haven't done hardly any Bible marking on, in the sense of verse by verse notes, but I've done enough on this that I feel so comfortable that I could give a series of talks without any marginal notes because of all of this sort of information. And Ecclesiastes would be one, I suppose, that fits into that category as far as I'm concerned, because of what I'm saying, that these things here are important. Now, this is the area, the microscopic view. That's where people start saying, now, the word here is so-and-so. All of this stuff in here is the microscopic. And, well, you know, that's important. But I really think, brethren and sisters, that we can all become students and do all or as many of those as is necessary, and hopefully that might help some people along the way who had been a bit frightened of Bible study or not quite sure where to start. Well, I'd like some comments from you, because that's not the be-all and end-all of how to do Bible study, and I'm sure there's others have got a few thoughts they'd like to make on that.
During the readings, you have maybe the family, one person who reads another translation, for example. Quite often that will open up the wide avenue of thought, which the AV may disguise perhaps because we're not using the language. And quite often using another translation, I think people open up to things like that and make things simple. And you'll see a connection to the
quickly, what Graham said, to save you having to worry about the microphone too much there, Peter. Graham said that we should refer to other translations, and that can be very helpful, and that is true. He went a little bit further than that, and I might have had to make a guarded comment
as to when and where we use other translations and which ones we use. The NIV is currently a popular one, and you'll see it in the Hebrews notes. Like all of the more modern translations, we've got to be very careful. Some of the newer ones pick up the idiom quite well, by which I mean that sometimes the older translations just took word for word, whereas of course in our common everyday talk, if we took everything we said literally, some things wouldn't make sense because there are things like figures of speech. Some of the newer ones pick up the figures of speech quite well, but they sometimes might be a little bit loose in their conveying of the real message. The NIV is not too bad. I think though that we would agree that in our general reading in meetings that we stick with the Authorised Version for all sorts of good reasons, and it's still got to be the basis of our Bible study. It's got to be the basis because all of the good books are still the ones that are key to the King James, the Authorised Version. There may be some coming out for others, but essentially Strong's and Young's and Jacenius and Englishman's and all those are key to the AV. But if you're like me, you go through a phase of liking one and then you go a bit cold on that and you get onto another one. It may depend on what book of the Bible you're doing. And sometimes when I'm reading the prophets, I will even go as far as reading Moffat, who is really quite criminal in what he does at times. He will actually take half a chapter and put it further on in the book because he thinks that's where it's better. And you've got to sort of shut your eyes to that. But if you're reading something and you can't get the feeling of it, well, Moffat will give you the feeling, be it right or wrong. He's very dramatic. And there's just an occasion where it pays to do that. And if you were reading something like, I presume, a Joel from Moffat, you could feel the locusts coming down like horses and you get the rhythm of the whole thing. I know the opening of Ecclesiastes. Utterly vain, utterly vain. Everything is vain. Man labours at his toil under the sun. What does he gain? And he rhymes all these things, you know, vain and again and rain and all this sort of thing. The rising sun goes down, it hurries round only to rise again. And so he's made Hebrew poetry sound like English poetry, which you just can't do. But at the same time, it gives you a bit of an impression. And I must admit, I've got Moffat marked in the margin on that particular part. So, all right, other translations are valuable, but just be careful. Well, we'll leave that. I've got one other transparency I'll put up. I said 10 minutes, didn't I, for that last one? 10 to 15? It was nearly 25 to 9 when I said that. That's only 22 minutes. Well, this one I will really... Grant you, keep an eye on the clock and tell me this time. This one is going to be 5 minutes, right? Because some of you have seen this before, our Junior Office Israel class. I would like to say, though, that whilst we're talking about Bible study, we ought to really also give attention to the reading of the Pioneer Works. And we can probably get this photocopied later or something if you wanted it. But inasmuch as we do have a Junior Office Israel class, and I will use this too as encouragement for people to do perhaps a little bit more preparation for that class and also for their own benefit. Whilst this is talking about how to conduct a class, really all of us are members of a class, especially if it's an informal one, and these are the sort of things that we should do. And what we're suggesting here in our aid to studying the Bible, in reading a book like Ilphus Israel, it does help us develop that maturity, because Brother Thomas was obviously a very mature student, and he can help us become mature students. So whilst the last transparency was sort of pure Bible study, this is enabling a speaker who is dead to help us through his written word. And I don't feel we need to be apologetic about that in any shape or form. Read the section carefully. Identify all Bible quotations, cited or implied. Don't run away from the difficult words. Look them up in a dictionary and write it in your margin. Note how Brother Thomas's translations may vary from the King James and be improvements. Where necessary, become familiar with the Greek alphabet. Okay, that's a point where some may opt out, but I would like to suggest that all of our young people should be capable of learning the Greek alphabet. They can learn much harder things at high school than that, and therefore there's no excuse why they couldn't learn the Greek alphabet perhaps not the Hebrew one, because I'm not too good on that myself yet, so I can't say something I'm not prepared to do myself, but the Hebrew one seems a bit harder for me. Note italicised words. That's the words in italics, because they're there for emphasis. Highlight what we've called quotable quotes and important statements. Brother Thomas makes a lot of quotes which are very quotable, and we often hear them in public lectures. You know, there is then a partial and primary restoration before the manifestation of Christ in the earth, these sorts of things. Prepare brief paragraph summaries. For more experienced ones, well, I don't know that we need to go through this, but for more experienced leaders, they should be able to anticipate future themes from key words. They should have been through the book several times, and they should know that the word sensuality and propensity on page 2 doesn't get defined until you really get to page 88. So in anticipation of page 88, you'd say a bit about it on page 2. Become familiar with the Hebrew alphabet. Well, compare statements in Elpis Israel with other writings by the same author, e.g. Eureka. If we were going to conduct a class, and this transparency was done actually about the middle of last year for a talk I had to give at the Silver Star Bible School, where the whole school was on Elpis Israel. Each of the three speakers spoke on a part of Elpis Israel. Each I did part 1, and Colin Badger did part 2, and Stephen Palmer did part 3. But I had to give a talk one night on how to conduct a class, and this was the whole talk. So conducting the class, read the passage and expound or discuss, or expound the theme, then read the passage. I might just say that in case someone's thinking of starting up an Elpis Israel home study class, there are two ways of doing it. You either read it first, then talk about it, or you talk about it, then read it. Our junior Elpis Israel class does that second one. The traditional class is the first one. Take notes and highlight important passages, and in the case of young people, test occasionally. Well, brethren and sisters, I said it was going to take up a fairly substantial part of the night, and that one didn't go past the 5 minutes. What we're saying, though, is that, and I apologised earlier in case some of you thought it was just a bit too simple, that Paul has told us that there's a chance that we're immature, in which case we've got personal problems and perhaps ecclesial problems. We've brought it down to the 20th century and said, well, are we any better than those? Is it possible that we could be mistaking the shadow for the substance? What are we going to do about it? To go into maturity means we've got to study the Bible. Therefore, we hope that those comments are of some value to us, even those who've been perhaps doing it for years. One last opportunity for anybody to make a comment before we go back and actually, believe it or not, complete chapter 6 this evening. The Companion Bible, of course, is the King James Version. It's got very extensive marginal notes. Many of the marginal notes are taken from other commentators like Ellicott and Adam Clark and that. When it's good... this sounds like a... there wasn't some nursery rhyme. When it's good, it's very good. And when it's bad, it's terrible. But the bad parts are obvious. I haven't used it much of late, but I used to some years ago, and I think Brother HP used to use it quite a bit, judging by some of the comments that I saw come out which were in there. It's got a number of appendices in the back which can be helpful. It gets us into the area of saying, to what extent should we use outside commentaries? And I suppose the Companion Bible would be one of the most concise of the so-called outside commentaries, and therefore to be viewed with some caution. But some of the appendices in the back which highlight the meanings of words and the occurrences of them can be quite useful. So is it still around nowadays? Can you still get that new? You can. Did you want to make an advert for it, Tony?
No.
Not really. What's it cost?
$30.
Oh, well, it's too dear for most to buy. I think it's got its uses, but we have to be careful. I know a brother at Enfield who calls it the Companion Babel, so he doesn't like it. Good. I'm pleased you're going to say something, Calvin.
Can you repeat that again? Because I've got to repeat it too. The degree of maturity that we have is directly proportional to the degree of humility that we have. I think you put it the other way around, but with the same end result. Is that right? Would you like to expand on that? So what you're telling us is that these things here are not an end in themselves, and they must not be seen to be an end in themselves, and we don't say, well, I've got 20 minutes, I can do Bible marking tonight, finished. Ah, you've got to have time to stop and think about what you've done. Just having got it in your margin doesn't necessarily of itself make maturity. Yes, we need to be careful about that. Let's be also sure on one thing: the maturity will never come if we don't do Bible study. If we do Bible study and we think about what we're doing, then maturity will come because the Father will bless us. So we've really got to stop and think about it and, of course, try and examine ourselves. And do bear in mind that the context in which we're talking here in Hebrews is to prepare to be priests. So if it's going to help us to have compassion on the ignorant and on them that are out of the way, recognising that we also are compassed with infirmity, the more we read the Bible, the more it'll make us recognise that we're not worthy of being here. It will bring about a humility. And so it will of itself, if we apply our minds properly to it, develop that. Yes, thanks for the thought, Calvin. Norm?
Prayer doesn't play a very great part in Bible study.
Prayer doesn't play a... Oh, does, yes. I was toying with the idea of whether I bring my old set of slides along that are now 30 years old, which say the five steps in Bible study. And the first step says, commence with prayer. It has the picture there of the lampstand in one corner and the altar of incense in the other, and it points out that every morning and every evening, as the lamps were trimmed in the tabernacle, so the incense was offered, which meant that the day would start with the word and with prayer. So step number one, approach the Father in prayer to ask his blessing. Step number two, read the word slowly and distinctly in order to gain the sense. Step number three, search for important words and key cross-references. Sorry, search for key words and important cross-references. I'll quote that right. Four, try to create a mental picture of the incident. Five, summarise your findings in the margin of your Bible. So that would be five steps to simplify it right down. And I have five slides, 35mm slides, which sort of go through those steps, which I think most of you have seen at some stage, and other illustrations of the same. So thanks for that point. Yes, Norm, that is obviously very important because it reminds us it's not an academic study. I guess what I have said sounded almost academic, but there's got to be, for some people, a pattern. So, well, how do we go about it? Well, what we've tried to do tonight is the how part. I hope you'll hear it in the context of all the other things we've been saying about maturity and so forth. But, yes, prayer is essential, isn't it? BDW. They're not.
There's no direct relationship between the Psalms and the hymns and the verse by verse notes. One must be very careful that it does.
Do you want me to repeat that? Did you hear that at all in the back? Didn't hear a thing. Brother Barry Williams just made the comment that regarding the Companion Bible, the Bullinger who wrote the Companion Bible commentaries used the work of J.W. Thurtle, a one-time Christadelphian, to highlight the significance of the titles of the Psalms, something that no other Bible compiler or translator seems to have done. And because he did that, and appears to have done it very well, and because Thurtle was at one time a Christadelphian, we may therefore be inclined to think that the comments on the Psalms themselves in the bulk body of the book might therefore be Thurtle's. And Barry tells us that they should not be as carefully followed as should the actual titles themselves, which you don't have to go to the Companion Bible to get, because Thurtle's work has been reproduced and made. Tony, again, it's...
It's in the library. Okay, so we can get it. But yes, the titles of the Psalms in the Companion Bible is probably one thing that made it popular with us. And the second point?
Was that there is an additional thing that comes out from the Hebrew class, which is not on the Earth analysis, and we often forget to do it. We look at the structure of the book, we look at the microscopic words, but we don't always say, hey, what does that verse or that section really mean? We can say the meanings of the words, but we don't always come to grips with the overall feeling for it. Paraphrase, which is coming
from the Hebrew, but
I think it's something that is very essential to be
had
to say what that page in our Bible is saying rather than
tell us the meaning of all. Yes, I found that personally very good. Barry has pointed out that paraphrasing our studies as we go along lets us know whether we really understand what we studied. You know, we could be wrong, but how often has a person marked up a whole lot of material in their margin? Then once someone says, well, what's it mean? And you can go through and say, well, this word means this and this means that. But to put it in your own words, you find it difficult. Now, there are paraphrases of the Bible out. That is something we should be very, very cautious about. Because with all paraphrases, they become subjective, don't they? I mean, Bible study that we've been talking about tonight is objective. You say that word means that, therefore it's this. But when you put it all together and say, well, what the writer is really saying in my words is this, it becomes the way I see it, and everyone in the room would probably write it a bit differently. Now, there are paraphrases of the Bible out that we need to be careful about. In fact, most of them. Barclay's translation is essentially a paraphrase. I suppose... Beg pardon? You wash your mouth out? The Living Bible, I don't think, is recommendable. From what I've seen of it, I haven't got one. If anybody's got one and wants to speak in favour of it, but I think it's... No, I think the Living Bible... I'm going to rush out tomorrow by Living Bible thing. No, I think the Living Bible is bad news. Barclay's not too bad. Sorry, I heard another one from somewhere.
Amplified.
Yes, I don't know the Amplified either. I haven't got it. Amplified Bible, reasonable? Not reasonable either. Brother Barling has done a paraphrase of Hebrews. My paraphrase is a bit like it at times and not at others. In fact, I'd have to say some of my paraphrase would be quite distinctly different from his, both in word and in meaning, but that's where you become subjective. I've got another one on the New Testament by a chap called Wade. It just turned up from somewhere and... Okay, well look, let's leave it at that and return to Hebrews now to see what Paul is now going to tell us. Picking it up then from verse 9, he says, "But beloved, we are persuaded better things of you and things that accompany salvation, though we thus speak." So despite the fact he says that I've criticised you, he says there are better things that you are, I'm sure you're capable of better things. "For God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labour of love which you have showed toward his name, in that ye have ministered to the saints and do minister." So the contrast which he's bringing out here is with the final outcome of those who bear only thorns and briars. Their end will be rejection and burning. On the other hand, fruitful works are justly considered by God. I think he's talking, though, about the fact that they had started off well and maybe in many respects they were labouring, but they were not doing it in a way that was more mature as we've been talking about it here. So verse 11 says, "And we desire that every one of you do show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope, even unto the end." You might notice that in verse 10... he spoke about their labour of love. In verse 11, he talks about the full assurance of hope. And in verse 12, he talks about those who through faith. And you notice he's got faith, hope and love, but in a reverse order there. Just worth noting. So then he says in verse 12, "That ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises." Slothful is the same word as dull back in chapter 5, verse 11. Remember where he says, we've got many things to say about this Melchizedek priesthood, and but they're hard to be uttered because you're dull. It's the same word as slothful. And you know, we might ask ourselves, what are we doing with our time? I know of, in specific sense, but you hear of people who say, look, I'm bored, I've got nothing to do, or don't know what to do with my time. Well, really, we just don't have enough time in life to do all the things that we want to do in regard to the scriptures. So we've got to be careful we're not wasting our time. Here were people to whom he's saying, don't be slothful. As I said, it's the same word as dull. The Hebrews are here being exhorted not to be lazy in their matter of applying themselves to the ecclesial duty, as they'd become in their application to spiritual perception. And that's, of course, to be contrasted with the diligence that he speaks about in the previous verse. We've already mentioned that the faith and patience that he speaks about here is going to introduce us to Abraham. And that's what he does then when we come to verse 13. There are a few other comments here that you can read from the notes. They're mainly of a technical nature, so I won't be tedious and drag those out at this stage. We'll just pick up the general idea of going through the general message that he's got here. Picking up from chapter 6, verses 13 to 20, you'll notice on the bottom of page 59 that we've got the subheading, The Sure Foundation of the Hope. Now, I'd like to just read a little bit of the note from the top of page 60. He says in verse 13, "For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he swore by himself." Now, Yahweh's words on that occasion, recorded in Genesis 22, verse 16, were this. He said, "By myself have I sworn, saith Yahweh, for because thou hast done this thing and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son." Now, the promise was because he had done this thing. What thing was it that brought such divine commendation? Well, the answer was, because thou hast obeyed my voice. This was the reason which was given to Abraham and repeated once again to Isaac, with the words, "I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham, thy father." The word obeyed is the Hebrew word shema, which means to hear intelligently, with the implication of perception and understanding. There was certainly no dullness of hearing, that is, being slothful, with Abraham, and such understanding produced faith and patience, which secured for him and all like him the promise of inheritance. So I think that's a very valid comment, tying up the case of Abraham with what Paul is saying. He then goes on to say in verse 14, he makes the quote, "Surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee." So the promise referred to in Genesis 22 verse 15 was given to Abraham unconditionally. And that's going to become quite an issue later in the book. In comparing the Abrahamic covenant with the Mosaic, the Abrahamic covenant consisted of a promise which was unconditional, and it was sworn on oath by God's own existence. Why then go back to the shadow? Verse 15 says, "And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise." So Paul picks up the terms faith and patience from verse 12, and he shows how there were these two important events in the life of Abraham in which he manifested these attributes. And we've mentioned it before, he was justified by faith and he was justified by works when he patiently endured, even to the point of being prepared to offer up his son. The bottom of page 60 and over the top of page 61, we've got a quote from Brother Barling, which I thought was very well written, and I've put it in, not in whole, it was actually much longer than this, but I'd like to read this. "Concerning Abraham, his faith had been tested to the uttermost, and he had not failed. Never would it be so tested again, nor would any contingency again arise to call in question the certain fulfilment of the promise. That promise was henceforth not conditional upon obedience, but it was immutable," that means unchangeable, because the requisite obedience had already been shown. By myself have I sworn, says God, because thou hast obeyed my voice. Before, it had been Abraham believed. Here it was, thou hast obeyed. There was no change in the faith which he was in each case called upon to manifest. The change lay simply in the mode of its manifestation. And what was so significant for the author of Hebrews was the fact that it was not until after he had thus patiently endured that Abraham obtained the promise. This last and preeminent promise, that is. That was why he urged his readers to be followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises, adding, "For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he swore by himself." And so really that's what life is made up of, isn't it? Continually applying ourselves to that word and patiently enduring and allowing the word to work in us. And you know, if we were to put that transparency back on the screen that spoke about the milk diet and the meat diet, all of us would look at that milk one and say, oh no, that's just not right, is it? We've just got to go on from there. We can't run our personal lives or our ecclesial lives on that sort of thing. It's a developing faith which each one of us must do, and of course it affects the body as a whole, doesn't it? And so he makes the point in verse 16 that men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. So he points out that when you make an oath, you swear by the greater. So verse 17 says, "Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath." But the oath that he swore by was on the basis of his own existence. So that verse 18 goes on to say that by two immutable things in which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have a strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope set before us. So what were the two immutable things in which it was impossible for God to lie? See if we've been following the text fairly. What were the two immutable things? One of them. God's promise was one of them, and his oath, that's right. So God's promise and God's oath, two unchangeable things. Now we can see, of course, what Paul is going to do with this. He's going to tell us that's the situation we're in. We are sitting here tonight, like those Hebrews 2,000 years ago, with God's promise, which is absolutely unchangeable. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Recognising, of course, that baptism doesn't just mean getting wet and coming out of water. It means a changed way of life. So God's promise is unchangeable. And he swore it on the basis of his own existence. So on the basis of his own existence, God says that I'm going to make your seed like the sand of the seashore. And as many of you as have been baptised into Christ have put on Christ, and you're Abraham's seed. And so we've got to think of the importance of what life is all about and of the promise that we're identified with. And if we can't find time for Bible study but we can find it for other things, then frankly, brethren and sisters, we don't believe. We don't believe what God is promising to us. And that's why Paul is emphasising the fact that there was two immutable, two unchangeable things, God's promise and God's oath. So in both of these things, it was truly impossible for God to lie because he can't deny himself. And so he says we can have a strong consolation, those who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope set before us. In this matter of fleeing for refuge, at one stage in the notes we had something there about the cities of refuge. It seemed as though there could be some connection, and I think Brother Carter makes an allusion to it, and Brother John Martin in his notes spends about two pages, I think, on it. And then I took it out, and I thought, well, if you want to make it the cities of refuge, okay, it might be, but the words aren't really the same. You know the story of the cities of refuge where one could run to if you'd accidentally killed somebody, then you could escape from the Avenger of Blood and you could go to the City of Refuge and stop there till the death of the High Priest. There could well be a connection, but I've left it out of the notes, and for those who like the connection, by all means go ahead and adopt it. But if you want to know more about that, you'll need to read John Martin's notes on that. And I think John Carter says a little bit about it. With due respect to John Martin, I think he got a little bit dramatic because he's got people hanging over the walls on ropes because he ties it up with the anchor somehow or other. Anyway, if you'd like to read that for yourself and take into account that I'm one end of the spectrum and John's the other, John will give you the colourful picture and I'm fairly dull. So if you get somewhere between the two, you've probably got a good balance on it. So that brings us then to verses 19 and 20, which really become the springboard for next fortnight. Because verse 19 says, "We have this hope as an anchor of the soul." That's where John gets the anchor, and he links it to somebody hanging over the wall of the City of Refuge on the rope. I mean, it sounds quite good. You read it through, by all means. But I'm not quite sure that I can see it going that far. So, which hope we have is an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil. Now, at this point, Paul is bringing us right back then to where we were a chapter and a half ago. He's going to talk now about the high priest, who, on the Day of Atonement, could go into the most holy place beyond the veil. Whither the forerunner is for us entered, even Jesus made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now, it would not be doing those verses justice to deal with them tonight, and I didn't really intend to, except to say, Paul didn't put the chapter divisions in. Somebody else did later on. This is really now the lead-in to what is going to be in chapter 7. So in many respects, about halfway through verse 19, the theme now returns to this Melchizedek priest. So what he has done is he's given us that exhortational insertion, or what have we agreed to call it, I can't remember what we agreed to call it, not a digression though, from chapter 5, verse 11, through to the end of chapter 6. He's hit us hard. He's told us there's a need for us to be mature as individuals and therefore as ecclesias. We've got to study that word, we've got to develop that faith, and we've got to develop that endurance. But bear in mind that God has given us an unchangeable promise, an immutable promise, based upon an unchangeable oath. And we know that the Lord Jesus Christ has entered into the true most holy place, into immortality itself. And the beautiful point is, he's the forerunner. And we are guaranteed by God. You know what I'm saying? We're not guaranteed a place in the kingdom because we happen to have been baptized. But the promise is there. To those who will have that faith of Abraham and to show that endurance, then the Lord is for us that forerunner. So we hope then that some of the practical thoughts coming out of tonight will help us in our understanding, and maybe you'd like to apply it to Hebrews and try to go a little bit ahead into chapter 7 in preparation for next class, when, God willing, we will return to the theme of the Melchizedek priesthood.
There are a couple of minutes to ask any questions or make any more comments.